So I went to Caltech in Pasadena, and we had one of those. And
Yeah.
my favorite story from there is that one of the DJs said, "So we got okay, we're giving away this whatever. 14th caller is going to get this whatever." And he hit the number that he said was 911-473 whatever. And he's like, apparently people kind of oh.
And you're telling that story now. Why, Biff? Why wasn't that story brought up a half hour ago?
And, the statute of limitations is up.
Hello, and welcome to Carnival Personnel Sideshow. I'm Jacques.
This is Biff.
I'm Joe.
And my friends, I don't remember being more excited, and we've had so many great guests lately. But in this case, I've been waiting for well over a year for this guest. I've, like the rest of you guys, social media is mostly a toxic waistband of awfulness, you know, with some great puppy videos. But either through our good friend, you know, John, our old bass player from Austin, or through Professor Cook, who's done our show a couple times, I was stumbled upon somebody they were following, and it's a professor at the prestigious Fitchburg, I don't know what it's called now, it was Fitchburg State College when I went there. And they were in the middle of writing a book, or they were starting to write a book, I think, when I followed them, on the history of college radio. And right away, I was dialed in. I've been following them for a while. It was kind of awesome to be a fly on the wall through the whole process as they unearthed different old fanzines or got interviews with different people, or their research turned up something that was quite unexpected to them that, you know, maybe changed a chapter or direction with part of the book here and there. So it was just absolutely fantastic watching this whole process. I pre-ordered the book as soon as it was available. I love that I have it. I also love that with my dyslexia, there's no way I can read a 450-page book, but that I also got the Audible version of it, which was a delight to listen to. And so we're going to get right into it. And please welcome professor, author, Catherine Rigel.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's great to be with you all.
And I don't want to embarrass you, but literally, I think in the pantheon of college radio, whatever you want to say, there was a book called Our Band Could Be Your Life. There's a compilation album called No Alternative. There's a compilation album, Voices from the Underground, and your book, I put in that as the definitive works on the music and the radio that has completely changed the course of my direction. And it was enthralling, to say the least.
Well, that's really nice to hear. It's really interesting writing a book about something that has so much meaning to so many people. And, you know, my first book is about long dead, really nasty people. And this is like writing a book about like really wonderful, lovable people who are like my friends. And so it's been really exciting to see people engage and talk about how much college radio and these music scenes have meant to them. So it's a real pleasure.
What I wasn't expecting, because, you know, I jumped into the foray in 89, and my first week at Fitchburg, I end up going to meet one of my couple brothers from that school through WXPL. You're not from Boston originally.
Well, I'm from Vermont, but Boston was kind of my home city. You know, I lived in Arlington when I was little. And so Gardner, the Fitchburg area I knew well. And so my mom's from Belchertown. So I was sort of in the orbit.
As you know, Boston is just, radio sucks. BCN, there's a great documentary on it, and BCN is the reason why there's, you know, radio to this day. It's so great. The history of it is amazing. But in the 80s, you know, the playlist of BCN, AF, all those bands is essentially the same. Following your book, what I wasn't expecting is the history lesson of how radio came to be, how land grants spurred on college radio, how Pacifica Radio, which I listened to Pacifica Radio and all those alternative verses are still out there, but you went so deep, these 1936 acts and stuff. Was that expected going in? Were you expecting that much of a legal
regulatory? Well, so the secret history is that I am a policy political historian. So in some ways, it's actually the politics of media and the kind of the regulatory stuff that got me into the subject. Even though I did college radio and it was very much a part of my life, I did not connect those two until I started writing the book, really, to think about like how much policy shapes the story. And I think for anyone who did college radio or loved college radio, you know, I think we don't see ourselves as having anything to do with the Washington, D.C. or these kind of suit setting rules about broadcasting licenses. It's like we're just there doing our thing. And, you know, we may have to deal with the university and its politics sometimes, but we don't have to think about, you know, how is what the chair of the FCC doing going to influence what we're doing? And I thought that I was going to write kind of this big history of like, here's this thing called college radio, here's how it came about. And like, I thought it was just going to be this little book. And then I get into the archives and realize that it's this massive history with all of these stories that no one had really told from a national standpoint. And that there was just so much, and I could never tell the whole history in one book. And so I actually have two books, manuscripts out of the research that I did. And so I had to do some of that backstory to be like, okay, here's where this comes from. But there's this whole 100 years of history that exists, well, 80 years of history that exists before I get into the real story of this idea of modern college radio, which is these alternative bands, what Michael Azarad talks about in Our Band Could Be Your Life, that, you know, so I sort of allude to this backstory, and there's so much there still to uncover and to unpack. But the story really takes off when college radio kind of splits from the WBCNs of the world and stops trying to sound like WBCN and becomes its own kind of college radio sound, which, you know, there's no one college radio sound, but we certainly associate it with these particular bands who really get known because of college radio.
Well, and then there's all these like protests that, you know, these heroes that truly, you know, were fighting campus administrators on this campus or that campus that wound up in front of the Supreme Court or just changed, you know, so much music. That for me was, I wasn't expecting to have a history of like Louisville. I wouldn't think a radio station in Kentucky would ever have had that much impact on what I ended up like loving as far as like college radio, like 30 years later. I also thought it was really interesting, all the perspective from the side of the record labels. The whole thing about how record labels started charging fees for college radio. Mm-hmm. That was, I never knew that that was a thing, and how that almost crushed college radio before it really started.
Yeah, there's these weird twists and turns in what we could think of as the business of college radio, which again, these are nonprofit stations. It's volunteer run for the most part. It doesn't seem to, there's nothing really professional about college radio, except that there's a lot of people that go into it to go into broadcasting. So they might want to learn that. But then all of a sudden, they start to deal with this, you know, world of the business of the music industry. And at first, it is all major label stuff on college radio, because there aren't a lot of small independent labels, and there's just not enough to fill up a rotation. And then in the late 1970s, along with the rest of the nation, the music industry kind of hits an economic scud, basically, and they have to cut these college radio promotions departments. And there's sort of a confluence of weird things. There's a regulatory change. There's this shift in the music industry. And this actually pushes college radio kind of further to the fringes. of embracing this kind of educational mindset of we're going to play things. That idea that we were always playing things that you couldn't hear on commercial radio was always there. But now it really starts to get attached to these very specific sounds and these very specific kinds of rock and roll bands that will, and hip hop, that will go into, this bigger kind of ecosystem of the music industry. And so college radio, as it develops this kind of national reputation in the 1980s, is doing so because it finds this particular role within the music industry as this kind of testing ground. At least that's how the major labels see it, as this testing ground for new artists. Now, of course, the participants are like, yuck, like we don't want to be the like stepping stone for somebody to go like become the next Peter Frampton. Like, we don't want that. We want to be experimental. We want to have always this cutting edge. We want to air voices that you can't hear anywhere else. We want to educate the listening public to stuff that will kind of blow their minds. And there isn't that kind of commercial impulse, but a lot of that reputation is built on the fact that they do carve out this place within the music industry, because there is a sort of tenuous moment where they could lose that relationship. And it actually forces a lot of stations, because of what the FCC does, to increase their wattage. So you get these higher power signals that actually makes them more valuable again to the major labels, because they're like, okay, it's not just reaching like 30 students in their dorm rooms. Like, now you could actually hear WXPL, you know, across sort of this larger radio market. And so it becomes more worth their while to give that record service to those stations. But as that idea of alternative music, of just in the 1970s, alternative meant anything that wasn't available on commercial radio. By the 1980s, though, alternative means a very specific kind of sound, where it's right, a particular rock and roll kind of guitar driven music. And so it's kind of a double edged sword, where it's sort of some of that wackiness goes away from college radio as it becomes known for playing this particular kind of sound. And so you start to get all these internal fights. Again, there's always internal fights over what they should play, but you start to get, you know, kind of the people who want to play the CMJ top hits. They want to play Big Head Todd and the Monsters, and they, you know, whatever's the biggest thing on the CMJ charts and is, you know, going to cross over to MTV. And then there's the people who are like, no, like we want to like push the envelope. We want to play, you know, this weird noise band that I heard and, you know, will never be heard on MTV. And so you get these battles over this thing of, you know, kind of authenticity, I guess would be the word that they might use, which of course is a totally loaded word and it means so many different things depending on who you talk to. But you get the kind of cultural politics of college radio shift in the 1980s as the music industry takes note of them.
So is it like one of those situations where, like, I kind of always felt like the once you get to a point where, because making videos were so expensive back then, right? If your video exists and appears on MTV, like, are you suddenly banned from some of these stations? Oh yeah, we're done with these guys because they're here.
Yeah, and it was really funny because you could see in the archives, they would, a lot of times people will complain, oh, I called up the station and they said they wouldn't play, you know, Simple Minds. And the DJs would be like, no, it's not that we won't play Simple Minds. It's just that now every teenager, now that they're being played on MTV, is calling in and requesting Simple Minds. So it's not that we'll never play Simple Minds. It's just, you know, our work here is done. And
That's a great point, right? Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is I've gone through my battles of like music snobbery. I admit that. And then there was always those things where if you glommed onto a band before, while they were playing The Rat or TT the Bears, before they got to the Paradise, and then after they went to the next step after Bun Radics in Paradise, it's like, yeah, I don't want to see them anymore. And when you said Peter Frampton, there's a quote in there where somebody's like, whatever city they lived in, it, when Peter Frampton's album Alive came out, they're like, in this city, he never died. And then, of course, there was the interesting things that you talked about when you would have the administration come in or consultants on behalf of the administration come in and say, well, only 5% of the students even know we have this radio station. Why are we catering to these freakazoids, I think, is what the now it's what one of the administration people like labeled the and rightfully so, guilty as charged. But I mean, that those kind of stories were just fascinating and frustrating. And I don't know, as you weighed it through, how you decided to pick out this protest or this one thing versus that going on at almost every college radio station.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, you gravitate to the most sensational stories for one thing, and just what you have archives for. So the one that you're referring to is the one at the at University of Kansas, where there's a whole chapter on what went down there. And there you have this kind of perfect cauldron of all of the different parties that want a bite out of a radio station. That's literally like they actually have a graph of all the different groups that want a bite out of KJHawk, right? Which is the radio station. And so you have really prestigious School of Journalism and the faculty there and those students who are, you know, they want to go be Walter Cronkite. And so they want, you know, literally Steve Doocy, the Fox News anchor, was a graduate of that radio station. So, you know, not the freakazoids on campus, right? Like they are like pretty square, pretty straight laced, want to do like hard news radio. Doesn't mean they don't want to have fun, but they're there to like get professional experience and the faculty wants to support them. And the administration, you know, is like also responsible for that, but they're also responsible for community relations and for all of the students on campus. And it's a student activity. It's paid for by a student activities fee, meaning all the station, all the students have a claim to it as a student activity, not just the journalism students. And so, and then you have the community members that, you know, there's punk clubs in the Lawrence, Kansas music scene is like really up and coming and, you know, gaining national traction. And, you know, so there's this sort of relationship that the university wants to cultivate with the businesses and the downtown and the residents of Lawrence. And all of these people have a legitimate claim to the station. This is the hard thing. It's like, you know, was I hanging out with like the square, straight-laced students who want the professional experience? No. But as a historian, I have to admit, like, you know, why does the station exist? Like, it's an educational station. They have just as much of a claim to it as the freaks who want to play hardcore instead of airing, you know, the NCAA basketball game, which caused a whole other fight as well. But over that, and they got into a lot of trouble for swearing on the radio station, and they got, you know, almost got the station taken over as a result, and an FCC fine ensues, and there's just all kinds of madness that happened around that station. And so, you know, that was a really good case because at all these other stations, you might see some subset of those people, those partisans fighting over a station. It might be the community versus students. It might be students versus students, students versus faculty, faculty versus administration. And so that one station kind of helps you see all of the different sets who have a claim to these stations. And yes, and there's picketing involved, and it's just kind of wild everything that happens there. And you know, so it's hard to reconstruct some of these stories as a historian. You know, you might only get one side. And so I would kind of gravitate to where I could at least get a sense of what was going on from multiple perspectives. But you know, if you take a step back and think about it, the world of college radio that still exists to for a lot of students where administration and faculty don't really get involved, it's kind of amazing that anybody ever let us do this to begin with.
100% is. But let's take a step back. Tell me or tell us about your college music, you know, experience.
So I went to Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, which is Music City, USA. But I was coming from Vermont in high school where, you know, mountains are sort of problematic when you're talking about radio signals. And so I was sort of channeled into one, you know, valley's worth of radio. And so I didn't get college radio when I was in high school. I got the Dartmouth station, but it was like basically a commercial rock station. And so I had no idea that students could get on the radio. And I get to Vanderbilt and they had this big station, really high profile, really tapped into the music scene. And I go to the student activities fair and they're like, yeah, you could do radio. And I was like, okay, sure. Let me on the radio. And so I joined, and it was like a whole other education for me. Like, you know, I have my education going on in my class and then I have my education at the radio station. And, you know, I met my best friend there, my roommate. Like, you know, she's actually coming to visit me later today, who the book is dedicated to.
Isn't that the best?
Yeah. And, you know, it opened this social world to me, and also, you know, going to bands. And so one of the great things about being in Nashville was a lot of times bands would come to record, and so they might play one-off shows. And so we were always getting exposure and insight into bands that were, you know, just around. I went to college with a guy named Ethan Alpat, who DJ Egon, who I don't know how he did this, but he became friends with Madlib and the guys at Stone's Throw Records, and was doing like kind of all of this like deep history of like hip hop beats and archiving, and, you know, figuring out like what band leaders were, you know, beats being taken from. And so he, you know, I met Madlib at the station when I was there. So that was like probably 1999. And, so I just got this exposure to this musical world and musical production that I never would have thought, you know, would have been part of my college experience. And so, and I think that's what's one of the great things about college radio is how it really supplements the university experience, that it's like a student activity on steroids, because you're doing this thing of engaging with culture, engaging with communities, doing this thing where you have a lot of responsibility, that it's kind of taking what you're learning in the classroom and making you kind of remix it and rethink everything you're doing in college. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's such a valuable experience for people who did it, because they see it as so much of a part of their kind of broadened horizons that tend to take place when you go to college for multiple different reasons.
Yeah, no, it's good. So was there like pretty extensive training, if you will, before you even allowed you on? Or like, because I mean, you know, there obviously we've heard FCC jokes over the years by all the comics mostly, but I mean, there, you know, there's I think people know that, well, you can't use certain words, but other than that, I mean, did they just say, oh, you know what, we need somebody to fill this time slot? Is that what happens? Or?
Oh, it depends on the station.
Okay.
And so it used to be you had to get a third class operator's license. They did away with that in like 93, 94, something like that. And so I didn't have to do that, but I did have to take a quiz. So I had a semester of training, and then I eventually became training director. But it basically just meant like pairing a DJ up with somebody who was already had a show, and they would show you how to use the board, and then they would let you like take over. So you kind of had to do somebody else's show your first semester, and then you had to get on the schedule and do whatever you want. It varies. Some stations still have a carrier current station where it only broadcasts through the wires on campus. And so they would have students be on the carrier current, maybe even for up to a year before they then let them onto the FM signal. Some stations, so WXPL right now, I did the training at Fitchburg State. So I'm technically a DJ, even though I've never been on air. They literally like walk you through the station and they're like, have fun. Like, come in, do whatever.
I have a question about the research part of the history of college radio. Now, radio in itself is very ethereal. It's documented, but it's probably the one single most, the largest medium with the largest amount of lost media. Mm-hmm. Were you able to like go back to the archives of, I mean, the availability of the air checks at certain universities probably vary from university to university, depending on how much they cared about doing air checks. College radio, I don't even know if kids even did their air checks. Like, I don't know what the policies were for recording these things. Like, how much, in your research, how much media did you actually find, have access to, knew was available in, you know, different regions? Like, is there more in the Northeast region, or, you know, or is there just specific colleges that kind of still hold on to, hey, you know, we still have air checks from 1968 or 1975 or 1982 from, you know, college radio?
Yeah, it's really scattershot. And you're right that there, the radio is this endangered species in the archives. So there is, I'm part of a task force. It's called the Radio Preservation Task Force. It's a project of the Library of Congress to try to ensure that this audio history is preserved, because I don't know what the numbers are, but you know, it's estimates of like 80 to 90% of our radio history is lost, if not more. Yeah. And so college radio, it's very haphazard as to what you will find. You know, so a lot of stations will have a recording of their first broadcast, for example, or, you know, they'll know what the first song was that was played, but there's stuff kind of scattered all over the internet. Some stations are more diligent. Sometimes alumni will have, like, they'll have a whole treasure trove of tapes. This happened at Princeton recently, where the general manager there was like, I have this alum who has like literally a garage full of tapes of air checks. And I think it's mostly air checks, but it was like a whole bunch of stuff. And it, like, what do we do with it? And you have the problem of digitization, and then that has a decay on it as well. And so the audio stewardship is a really complicated thing. Luckily for me, because I'm interested more in the politics of the behind the scenes of what was went out over. So there's some historians who are and media studies people who are really interested in the audio sound and that experience of radio and what goes out over the air. I'm more interested in the meeting minutes of like, what are they fighting about before stuff gets onto the air? What is the record, you know, label conversation look like? And what are, you know, the callers coming in, rather than kind of the structure of individual shows and playlists. So, you know, cause I'm not a musicologist either. So, and I was able to kind of get access to that paper record to write a lot at, you know, the student newspapers is another really great resource that tend to be digitized. And so I could do a lot of research, thank goodness, during a pandemic remotely. Lots and lots of fights. I always tell people college newspapers are like a treasure trove, because I don't know if you remember the letters to the editor, probably, of your student newspaper.
Well, what was interesting in the book is the student newspapers had been granted First Amendment rights. Radio stations were not. And I thought, wow. And so in some cases, you had student newspapers that were real allies to the radio stations. And in other cases, you had real, you know, vendettas, you know, against one another, which is just fascinating.
Yeah. And it's really interesting, because actually one of the big court cases about student press comes from Fitchburg State, which is the Antonelli v. Hammond case. It was ruled in the state court level. Where was it? It was a federal court, Judge Garrity, who did the busing decision, ruled in that case because some Fitchburg State students at the newspaper wanted to publish an Eldridge Cleaver essay. And it had some four-letter words, and the newspaper publisher was friends with the then president of the university or the college at the time. And he called up the president, was like, hey, these students want to publish this essay. And the president said, don't publish it. The student sued, went all the way to court, and they won. And so the press is seen as this, you know, First Amendment protected space. With radio, the trustees usually own the license. And so they get to determine what goes out over the airwaves. And so the FCC has certain rules. When it comes to obscenity and indecency, they usually, at least until the late 80s, kind of deferred to local tastes, local standards, which led a lot of, a lot of gray areas as a result. And so when when KCSB at Santa Barbara got in trouble for airing a hardcore song that had some euphemisms, let's call it, the university cited Antonelli v. Hammond to be like, students have First Amendment rights. And the FCC was like, nope, sorry, they don't. This doesn't apply. It applies to print only. You trustees own the license. They get to decide. And it's mostly the case not every radio station, college radio station, has its license owned by the trustees or the president.
Now that you mention it, do you take any accountability or feel bad for the PTSD you caused in me? Because I haven't thought of Tip O'Gore in a long time. I haven't really thought of the FCC. The horrible stories about how Sean Hannity came to prominence on college radio, which is just, I had to take a shower and then I went back and showered again because I just felt, no, I love college radio. I don't want to think that this is a platform that gave rise to that.
Yeah, I mean, he put out his shingle in the trade press for radio as the most controversial college radio DJ. That was how he got his kind of first commercial talk radio gig. And yeah, I mean, I think one of the things we forget about the whole PMRC, Tip O'Gore, parental advisory sticker thing is that that was very much focused on consumers, of people buying albums. And we forget that they had this whole other career basically getting radio stations in trouble. And it's really funny because, like, on the one hand, you know, people like Dee Snider and Frank Zappa appearing in front of Congress, they were much more focused on the people should be able to buy what they want, and like the individual consumers should be able to have the freedom to purchase what they want without any interference. But when it came to broadcast, the conversation proceeded very differently. And, you know, there people kind of accepted that there had to be these limits. And, you know, so much was done in the 1980s around what we would think of as censorship. But really, it was a kind of regulatory policy around, you know, protecting innocent ears, protecting children from being exposed to this. That's usually the cover that was used. And I think what's interesting about that story, though, is it shows us how those politics of culture in the 1980s get nationalized. Whereas so before, it was those local interests that got to decide what was determined as indecent. Obscenity, that was kind of a different thing. Indecency, though, that's really where things got muddy. And as those politics get nationalized, now all of a sudden you have these little stations in Santa Barbara, you know, where maybe, you know, you had one guy who was like mad about this like kind of filthy song. And now all of a sudden he could get the FCC to act on behalf of this constituency, right, where he's like the only guy. And so it brings those culture war politics kind of to the local level and lets us see how ordinary Americans participate in those battles beyond just like, you know, oh, if it has a parental advisory sticker, I know that that's the album to buy. That's the cool one.
Right. Well, that's the amazing thing about how college radio, you know, came to be in the first place. How it survived, because it had everything going against it. We already talked about how the record companies didn't see it as a viable, like moving the needle, pun intended, for record sales. So if you want our records, you have to buy them from us. We'll give you a discount, but you have to buy them. And they were shoestring budgets. You had, you know, people in the administration, you know, against them. You had the FCC. What do you think the biggest hurdles now face college radio?
So a lot of it has to do with radio audiences, that younger people are not listening to terrestrial radio the way that they used to. It doesn't have the same kind of cultural power in their lives the way that it did, you know, the way that it served as kind of a lifeline for a lot of young people. And listening in their room, bedrooms, or on their Walkmans, or whatever. And so it doesn't have the same kind of cachet. I think it still has a lot of power. It's just not necessarily going to be what it was for those of us who went through it in the 80s and the 90s. And so I think there, college radio has always been this very diverse thing. It's meant many different things across its 100-year history. And it can mean something new. It's just that we have to kind of give students the space to figure out what that is. to let them know that these things exist and give them the opportunity. I mean, you know, the biggest challenge for my students in doing college radio is they got to go work, you know, 20, 30 hours a week. They don't have time to go volunteer at the radio station. It's not paid, right? And so that's kind of the biggest challenge for them. You know, they might want to do radio. It's just like, how, what's the incentive?
Is there like a departure of, I mean, I think that at some point there was a little bit of glamour involved, right? And is that, we lost a lot of that. Is that part of it?
I think there's just more game in town, right?
Like, right.
You can have a podcast, you can, you know, have your own, you know, SoundCloud, or, you know, you can, you know, have a YouTube channel that there's just more opportunities for people to get their voice out there. And so even if they still want to do college radio, they kind of got to see what the payoff is going to be and who's listening. And I think institutions need to kind of lean back into the community connections that these stations provide, you know, like Fitchburg, where it's located. You know, you have a lot of people around the campus who don't have access to media in the same way, right? That Fitchburg State Station could be providing a lot of community access, you know, whereas before you might have had a full schedule of lots of people clamoring to do this. Now there's a lot of room in the schedule. And so you can bring in maybe a few community DJs to do, you know, there's gotta be like, you know, a Dominican DJ who like is like big in the area, like a club who could then also have a radio show.
Well, you know, you touched on that. It's like one of the problems college radio has, you go dark for 3 months of the year. Certain colleges, there's nobody there. And so that was one of the other problems that they faced. It's like, well, from the record company side or whatever, it's like, why, you know, going into the third quarter, why are we sending you stuff that, you know, at the end of the second quarter, because the third quarter, you're not here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so that was another, I want to circle back to Joe's questions about like, you know, the lost media and air checks. Do you have any of your air checks when you were a college DJ?
Absolutely not. Like, God, I hope they're not out there somewhere too. Like, I know that there was somebody recorded one of our shows one time who was on air. I have no idea if that tape still exists. But, you know, one of my hopes and dreams is to though get access to all of those tapes that exist in people's basements or attics and get them digitized through the Radio Preservation Project and get them. So one of the projects that I'm working on, it is called the Sound Submissions Initiative, and essentially owners of media get to keep their tapes and maybe, you know, and we'll get them digitized, and then they get stored at the Library of Congress to be listened to on site. So you know, one of the challenges, not to get too nerdy about this, is there's a lot of copyright issues involved. So, you know, the tape might be 30 seconds of me talking, and then it's like Pixies songs and Stereolab. And so you can't just like put that in an archive without some rules around it. So the deal with the Library of Congress is and having it available on site deals with some of those copyright issues.
You know, because when we, you know, at XPL in our day, we would use our radio shows to make our own mixtapes. Like we couldn't afford, you know, to go out and buy these 7 albums. So it's like when you would think, oh, what am I going to play tomorrow? What am I going to play tonight? It's like, and you would just set up your boombox to record your show just so you could have your own, you know, tapes. I sadly don't think any survive, but I will definitely submit mine if they do. But
I think a big hurdle of the archiving and the preservation of college radio, the biggest hurdle might be personal embarrassment. Like people might have these treasure troves of archived media from their college days, and they're like, I don't want this out there. Nobody's listening to this.
I've told no one in my life now about this, and they're never going to find out.
Yes, exactly. I don't want to be canceled from something I said in 1982.
That is a scary, excellent point. So I got to tell you, it was, it's towards the end of the book. We live in a world of now 8.5 billion people. And I was just telling Joe, I didn't even get a chance to tell Biff this. It is crazy how small the world is, because In your book, you were talking about certain people who, certain schools that were launching pads for people in the industry, whether executives, whether, you know, LA Time, you know, writer or a music critic and stuff like that. And I think it was Syracuse. Gosh, I should know where he went to college. You mentioned a guy named Dermot Quinn.
Mm-hmm.
Dermot. Okay. Dermot is one of my closest friends in 20 years in LA. I know Biff through hockey. Almost 95% of my friends come through hockey because LA, you know, late 90s, mid 90s, hockey was a tiny bubble, but everybody knew everybody, and all of my contacts came through hockey. And Dermot is a hockey guy. He's going to be coming on the podcast pretty soon. But when I heard that, I'm like, gosh, this world is absolutely tiny. I was super, super, super excited to hear that. I didn't know Chuck D started in college radio. I thought, well, because like, I always know Sebado, but I don't know that side of the world because it wasn't on my playlist until years later. But that was an interesting thing.
Like, touching on that, is there, in your research, did you find that there was like any sort of like racial component in certain decades? Like, because colleges are traditionally, or at least were traditionally, mostly white, and just generally. So you're already getting that filter. And then that, of course, dictates what the college radio sounds like, you know, what the music is that the people who are doing college radio at those universities and colleges are actually into. Mm-hmm. Was there like a barrier, or was there a point in time where it was like a fight to get more diverse people on the air versus like, all right, yes, we get it. All the prog rock is fine. And all this all music is great for the whiteies, but like maybe get some other music on board. Like, was there any sort of push to get that diversity going from the outside or the inside of college radio?
Yeah, and that's a real big thread of the book, because I am dealing with predominantly white institutions, and you know, the story of college radio at the HBCUs, places like Howard University launches the Quiet Storm format in the 1970s, and then historically Black colleges and universities kind of have their own very particular college radio history that's really, really interesting and vibrant, also has some archiving challenges as well, which is one of the things I ran into. But at these predominantly white institutions, you know, this is an era where, you know, we're after kind of the Black campus movement. We're after these efforts to bring in more students of color and to make them much more accessible. And so you have a lot of students on campus who are like, okay, great, like I'm here, but like this institution in no way represents me or my culture. And the radio station is included in that. At the same time though, a lot of these radio stations were really important community points. So you would have, you know, Italian language news or, you know, kind of polka shows. You would have jazz had a really big foothold in college radio, and sometimes much more experimental, sometimes more kind of middle of the road, sort of speaking to kind of, you know, white, you know, kind of jazz connoisseurs. But the college radio station was where those communities who didn't have a lot of exposure on mainstream commercial radio could get access. So in New York City at Columbia University, you have Haitian Creole language programs that got really political and actually got into a lot of trouble in the mid 1980s as a result. And, you know, that leads to them picketing. And, you know, Columbia University like has a lot of issues with community relations. And so the radio station is this really important way that universities can do that kind of outreach. But then you get a really interesting kind of cultural politics as students start to want to do the work of cultural representation. And so you have really well-meaning white students who are saying like, we're here to represent the music of these people who don't have access. But then you kind of have these problematic moments of where it seems like these white students are kind of, you know, cosplaying, for lack of a better word,
appropriate
like these different cultures, and or like, you know, like, oh, I love hip-hop, you know, I play like two hip-hop show songs on my program,
I have Vanilla Ice and Snow, I mean, I don't know what you guys are complaining about.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, they want to do this, and so they kind of run up against, you know, the predominantly white institution of like, who's here to do this, and does, you know, a student who wants to come on and play mostly like R&B that's maybe already getting play on MTV, it kind of cuts against this sort of underground thing, and you know, maybe they're not playing underground hip hop. So the cultural politics is really interesting because it lets us get a glimpse into how people are thinking through these questions of pluralism and cultural diversity as these are becoming like really lightning rod issues at the national level. And we're trying to think about, how do we get our institutions? What does it mean to be a representative institution and to provide access to all of these different voices? And so it you know, there's not easy answers to those, right? Because it actually matters who's on the executive board,
right,
as much as it matters who's on the air.
I mean, that's the same thing at the college itself, right? I mean, the college itself grapples with that, you know, like constantly. So I guess that just translates, I guess, down, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there a certain renegade aspect to it, though? Because it is student run. It's like, you know what? You know, we do what we want, and because the administrations are a lot more, you know, they have to be a lot more calculated and a lot more, you know, thoughtful. And then the students are, you know, we do what we do. Does that happen?
Or? It does. And, you know, another dynamic that comes in is that you oftentimes have community DJs who have longstanding shows, you know, that have been going on for decades in some cases. And so they have a really dedicated following outside of the university. And so they're sometimes clashing with the students who are, you know, they want to kind of do their wacky thing and play all this really avant-garde stuff, whoever it's from. And, you know, they kind of see the community DJs who are really providing that kind of cultural touch point for these underserved communities. You know, they like, well, there's only 168 hours in a week. And like, you got to divide it up, programming up somehow. And, you know, so there's, so they might really be kind of on the cultural kind of avant-garde side, but they're in a little bit of tension with some of these community groups sometimes. Sometimes they're in total partnership against the administration. So you really get like all of these different permutations of interest, really depending on the local radio market. And that's, I think, one of the magical things about radio in this era is that you still have this really strong kind of local character to it.
One of the political stories that I really loved, and it's funny because just recently, you know, it came up on my shuffle. I'm like, oh, I wonder if that would fly today. The Cure's Killing an Arab, like that whole story. And then I was thinking, it's like, oh, would Rock the Casbah work today? It's like, would that fit? Is that, you know, I mean, that story and the Jella Biafra story, which I've already mentioned. Something from the counterculture. It was a compilation of spoken word where they kicked down the door because he had a poster. It was called Penis Landscape in with their album. And this is a work of art that like hangs in the Louvre or somewhere. It's a famous, some Tipper Gore, you know, thought that that was distributing pornography, but you addressed that. But yeah, the Killing the Arab thing. I'm like, oh, wait. I never thought The Cure as being this in the middle of a political debate kind of band.
Of it has to do with, you know, like who these college radio DJs and audiences were in as they're getting embroiled into these national debates over the culture wars. And, you know, culture war politics, they don't divide neatly along partisan lines. And I think that's one of the things that's so fascinating about them is because it goes much deeper than kind of partisan politics type issues. And, you know, and the Cure incident one, the DJ and the Cure assumed that people had kind of read existentialist literature and kind of understood the reference. Whereas like, you know, not everybody understood that, you know, it was sort of talking about this, you know, well, I forget the book, The Stranger or something like that. I forget which one it was, but it was, you know, not being an existentialist literature expert myself. But, you know, it's sort of like this elitist kind of culture that college radio, and that was at the Princeton University station, which had this really strong community orientation. But then, you know, here gets this, you know, this DJ's mistake. He had a really thick Southern accent and he pronounced the song Killing an Arab. And that was really offensive, obviously. And this gets picked up into the national press. And, you know, and that guy, he's like, you know, oh my God, like, I just thought, you know, we were like playing The Cure. And like, I, you know, I didn't know that this was going to be like in, you know, the Village Voice. And, you know, here he is kind of boiled. And so you have this really interesting, you know, these issues that kind of cut across of sort of these elite institutions and kind of these arcane conversations that they have over literature and culture combined with students learning and this like weirdness of taking conversations. And this happens to a lot of students, you know, they're used to debating things in a classroom where that's a really protected space. And, you know, that gets sort of
pre-cell phones.
Yeah, pre-cell phones. And like, you know, it, you know, there's a lot of politics and hand-wringing over, you know, what goes on in college classrooms and, you know, snowflakes and like all this, you know, speech warnings and stuff. But in a sense, these are places for students to kind of figure out what they think about these really complicated, difficult issues where there's no clear kind of right and wrong. And so you have these cases where students are taking conversations that are happening on a college campus in this kind of protected bubble, but then they have them on the radio station and things aren't the same when you're on a radio station. So there's a couple of instances in the book where, and one at Vanderbilt, my own alma mater, where students try to bring KKK members.
Yeah, and you referenced a couple different schools where people, and it's like, well, we're going to bring these people on to really chew them a new one.
We're going to show how racist they are. Right. And it's like, you're platforming a terrorist what you're doing.
Right. And then at the same time, when people, I forget what school we had a problem. Like, Joe was a Howard Stern guy. I, you know, at one point, like in my youth, did like, you know, his nemesis. Now I'm
Don Imus.
Because Don Imus used to have Kiki Friedman and the Texas Jew Boys on all the time, which asshole from El Paso is one of my favorites. And they ain't making Jews like Jesus anymore. Those two songs, I must have played on XPL a dozen times, you know, and then I hear, oh, other people kind of played them too. That you had so many of those stories, but yeah, Vanderbilt bringing in the Klan was just delicious.
It was really boneheaded. And, you know, but it also shows us how, right, what are often kind of these local conversations, they shift in character, they get viewed through different lenses when it's seen through the national lens. And you know, so they take on different dynamics and different meanings when you shift the context.
Well, the other thing that gets overlooked, these are kids. Mm-hmm. They're 18, they're 19, they're 20. I can say emphatically, I will never stop thanking Batman that cell phones weren't around in my Fitchburg days. I won't elaborate on that. But yeah, I mean, these kids are 18, 19, and they're in the crosshairs of Tipper Gore Supreme Court hearings. They think they're smarter than guys in the KKK, and hopefully they are, but it's like they didn't think that through. you know.
But again, like not a lot of people. Morton Downey Jr. on national television was bringing on KKK members. Say what you want about Morton Downey Jr. He was a prick of a person, but he was a national guy, and it was sort of like in the air in the late 80s of this sort of sensationalist, like, you know, Oprah would have on, you know, some very controversial figures in the exercise of let's expose these people, because if we shed a light on them like cockroaches, they'll scram and they'll be embarrassed. No, actually, whoopsie daisy, we figured out, you know, decades later that no, it actually gives them, it empowers people that, you know, push hate speech to be more emboldened in their message and to, you know, reach a wider audience because of well-meaning idiots on college radio.
So we will wrap it up and let you get going after a couple quick points. First of all, thank you for writing the book. It was, it just, like I said, following your process over about an 18-month window when either Chris Cook or Hunt, you know, pointed me in your direction was just so much fun. So thank you for posting it. Thank you for, like, letting people like me follow along. It was awesome. I couldn't wait to get the book, and it was everything I had hoped, because college radio, just the music, just the experience, meeting my best friend through there. Thank you so much for writing this book, because I'm quite sure you are hearing this from a lot of people, that you encapsulate it like one of the most fun aspects of college life for me.
Well, that's awesome. It's really nice to hear. I'm so glad it resonated in all the right ways.
And now the second thing, the next book that you and I are going to work on, you touched on it a little bit. CMJ spun off VMJ, and because of VMJ, that's how I met Joe. At Fitchburg, it was great. I basically failed out. I graduated, but barely. But because I had access to equipment, I was able to make music videos that, because I had a syndicated music video show.
Cablevision.
Thank you. But I found out about VMJ, and I ended up getting moved to LA because of that music video show, because of sketch comedy show. But VMJ, what ended up happening is record companies didn't have college promotion departments anymore, but the different A&R reps would hire individual promoters to promote their bands. I would get a mailer from Warner Brothers that would have 10 videos on it. I was on their alt rock mailing list, and I was on their rock mailing list, and six of the videos would be the same, but I would play the one that MTV was. But VMJ, and because you only had to get on like 20 or 30 charts, we would regularly chart. We couldn't afford to put out a record ourselves, but because I had a cable access show and I got all these 3/4 tapes, I would just tape over a tape after I used it, send it to these other shows. We would chart all the time, to the fact we got a 2-page article of Billboard magazine, because we couldn't put out an album, but we put out a full length video album all through VMJ. So when you started mentioning CMJ, which was great, and then I'm like, I kept waiting. It's like, please talk about VMJ. Please talk about VMJ, which is its, you know, cousin. You know, I didn't know, sibling, more of a sibling. So when you're ready to start working on that book, I'm all in. I'm dyslexic and long-winded, but
long-winded. Really, you've been talking the last 5 minutes.
But when you're ready to start that book, but again, thank you for writing the book. Thank you for coming on. Tell us a little bit about the book and where you can get it, and how that process has been going for you as far as a writer.
It's good so far. I mean, I'm doing a lot of podcasts. It's available wherever you can get books. You can order it through your local retailer or through UNC Press, which is where it is published.
The title, of course, is The History
title of is Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. Came out December of 2023, and it's got the record spines on the cover. You'll know it.
I've had my, you know, how many people like me have, you know, taken a screen grab and expanded it so you could see the different records?
There's a little too much Bruce Springsteen on there for my liking.
but I definitely did that. and I we go to the Tingsborough Library so my kid could get his manga books, and I've had them get it. My sister's librarian in North Reading, and she's had their library order it and stuff like that.
Awesome.
It's fantastic. And again, I also got it on Audible, because there's no way, you know, if Biff sends an email that's more than 3 lines, I have to have the computer read it to me.
You have the amazing ability to send these extensive.
I can write like a mother. I can't spell well, but I can write a whole thing. But yeah, I can't read more than a post-it note. But seriously, thank you for writing this book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for posting and letting us follow, the people like me follow you. And I will post all your socials.
Oh, yeah. So I think I'm on them all. So at this point, so different variations of Kate or Kate
Jewel. Joe, any final thoughts, Joe?
No, I just want to thank Catherine again for coming on. Oh, Jacques, one more thing. Don't forget. They squint.